Peter Carey has published 12 novels, and he's won the Booker Prize twice. The first time it was for Oscar and Lucinda, his 1988 novel, which is this month's Low-Paid Show Book Club selection. It tells the story of an unusual romance in 19th century Australia involving Oscar, a nervous Anglican minister, and Lucinda, an heiress. The two share a guilty pleasure and passion for gambling. Oscar and Lucinda is published in paperback now by Vintage, and I'm very pleased that it brings Peter Carey, whose most recent novel is The Chemistry of Tears, back to our show. So it's good to see you, Peter.
It's lovely to be here again.
And we invite questions from our listeners. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org and also on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Peter, both Oscar and Lucinda are eccentric, and a lot of that has to do with their parents. Oscar grew up in England with an especially difficult father. Can you describe him as a person and how he shaped Oscar?
Well, when I was inventing Oscar, who I wanted to be an Anglican clergyman, I wanted him to be in rebellion against something. And yeah, Anglican clergymen tend not to be very rebellious types, so I had to sort of look for somebody who he could rebel against. And So I found a model, and actually I've forgotten the name of the damn model. You'll remember because you'll know who it is. Anyway, he's Theophilus Hopkins, and he's a very strict fundamentalist preacher.
But he's also a naturalist.
Oh, he's a naturalist
and rejects
as well.
Darwin's theories.
Yes, but he said the thing that first attracted me to the historical character who I based him on was him coming in, finding his son being fed Christmas pudding by the cook, and the father snatching the pudding out of the child's mouth and hurling it into the fire because that was the fruit of Satan. So, but
celebrating holidays like Christmas was also was something that was not to be done.
No, absolutely not. So here's somebody he could rebel against, I thought, and it's a sort of a sad story because of course the father and the son really love each other completely. But the taste of the Christmas pudding, where the child can't really believe that this is evil, and that's the sort of seed of doubt in his relationship with
his father. So he becomes an Anglican minister instead.
Mm. Well, he goes to stay and live with Anglicans. He comes to that sort of conclusion by a complicated game of sort of throwing lots, which says, will I do that or will I not do that? And this is his way of talking to God, as you know, in the Old Testament. People cast lots to see what was God's will. Oscar's gambling really begins with that moment as a childish thing of throwing a stone.
He's living with the Anglican Reverend Stratton and his wife, who are very poor, and he doesn't want to be that poor. He doesn't seem to feel all that guilty about his gambling at first. Does he believe that God approves of his gambling habit because he's good at it, a kind of a Calvinist explanation?
Well, God's... Yes, well, if you believe that the throwing of lots is the way that you know God can give you directions and help you choose, and if you're in the position of being exceptionally poor and you discover by another form of gambling that you can be given money to live on, then that seems quite reasonable that God is looking after you. And indeed, that's what he believes. He does feel a little guilt as well.
At Oxford, he's called Oddbod. In what ways is he a misfit?
Well, he's strange in every particular way. I mean, he's strange. Firstly, his whole class background is completely different. He's sort of exceptionally naive and unworldly. He comes from this fundamentalist background. He's very, very pale and tall and thin with brilliant red hair. He's just really strange and unworldly.
Why did you create a character like that? Because you wanted to send him to Australia, where you grew up?
You know, when I first... Yes, I did want to do that. I mean, it begins in my imagination. It begins where the book ends, which is in Australia with Oscar in a glass church floating up a river. But the first notes I made about the book, the things that were in my mind was like a very bright red salmon returning up river to spawn. And out of the image of that salmon, which was all associated with my dear, him going upstream in this church and drowning and dying, comes this intense color red. And I also wanted him to look like, in the family photograph, someone of enormous sort of Victorian rectitude. And I wanted then to find out that, in fact, he would not be like that. So his form, for me, when you're writing with a character like that, it's sort of like playing with silly putty or something. You can make them fat and short, or stretch him and make him long and thin and give him bright red hair. Well, that's how he sort of ended up, poor fellow.
Well, you suggest that you started with this image that inspired you of a salmon. Mm-hmm. Is that how many of your books, or all of your books, start?
A different fish for different books.
No, could it be a smell? Could it be sunlight coming through the window?
Well, this was actually a more that was of the great mess of the beginning of a book, that aspect of the salmon was one. The other was living in this in the country in northern New South Wales, which is subtropical, and coming into this valley every day and seeing this little church, which I was quite, being an atheist, I was quite fond of. And then the church wanted to take it away, and I became violently angry. Why are they taking this church away? And then I thought, why are you, an Anglican, becoming angry? And so on and so on. And through all of this, I get to this moment where that church comes into the valley, and I imagine it floating as a box full of Christian stories floating through a landscape filled with Indigenous stories. And that's where it started.
And you've answered a question that one of our listeners wrote in on our show page. What inspired the fictional idea of moving a glass church across a vast expanse of Australia?
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? I mean, the minute I want to put that church on a barge, I have to think, well, this is symbolically perfect. But who would really, really, really do such a thing? And my first thought was, somebody wants to sell something. Somebody's demonstrating a product. My other thought was, it's a bet. And I began to think about how that fit with religion. Pascal's idea of believing in God, that it's a bet we take. And if we're right, we get all eternity. And if we're wrong, we've just had a good life. So that's okay. But I was talking to my friend, an architect. And I wanted a prefabricated structure because I was imagining somebody demonstrating something. And I said, didn't the Victorians have this prefabricated, building technology? And he said, well, yes, of course they had it for glass houses. And he said, why? And I said, well, this is what I want to do with this church. He said, well, why don't you make it a glass church? And I went, And I had the book because it had everything that I really knew I wanted.
And glass has all sorts of other significances.
Yes. I mean, it has this great purity and clarity, and it also, it breaks and it cuts. And this is, of course, one of the things that this book is about the European invasion and conquering of the Indigenous people's land.
My guest is Peter Carey, whose Oscar and Lucinda is the subject of this month's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club, now available in paperback from Vintage. Well, before we get to, let's talk about race for a moment. You write a lot about it in this book, Land Stolen from the Australian Aboriginal People, who are called blacks. Were they called blacks when you were growing up in Australia?
Oh, yeah, and well before that, too. I mean, I think the reality of the race is easier to see in Australia. I mean, race is everywhere in the United States. But in a funny way, something in Australia is much clearer, in that this was a land owned by the Indigenous people, into which Europeans came and took the land and killed many of the people. And we still, to this day, Australians do know that the Indigenous people know how to live in that land in a way that we still don't. And if you cannot be an Australian without engaging with this issue about the land and how are we here, it's also, one doesn't really necessarily want to go into the thing of assuming or burgling the stories and culture of this people. So one of the things about this book is that really it's the basis of the book in one way. There's very little dramatization of Indigenous life.
Well, it's kind of a merging of what happened in this country, because we had both slavery and we also did something similar to the Native Americans.
Oh, yes.
But there were Australians who actually supported the American Confederacy during the Civil War because they saw our situations as being similar.
I was not really aware of that, but it doesn't surprise me in the tiniest bit.
With Lucinda,
they're more, the situations are completely different, but They do have that similarity, yeah.
Would this Lucinda be seen as an oddity because she sympathizes with the Aborigines?
Oh, yes, but, you know, like, oddities always exist, and they exist in every period. So, I mean, she's hardly anachronistic, but she's rare, I suppose you would say.
Because there are others in the book that talk about how the Aborigines should be poisoned and killed.
Yeah.
Lucinda's parents both died before she was 18. What was her upbringing in Australia like?
Well, I think her father died, and the mother was left with the farm. And the sort of belief that she was smart. I mean, she was a feminist, I suppose. You'd say 19th century feminist.
Well, Lucinda stands out because she wears trousers.
Bloomers.
Oh, bloomers, okay.
Invented by Amelia Bloomer. I can still remember these things from 25 years ago. Yeah. And, you know, she's trying to run this farm and run this farm very well. In fact, she's an intellectual who has correspondence with intellectuals in England. But she truly, truly hates where she is. This is the mother. And can't bear to see what she has done to her daughter, who is at home and happy in this sort of dreadful place. And she has made her independent and made her believe things will be socially unacceptable. And that the mother fears that she will be intensely... She's left her in a very, very vulnerable situation. The one thing that it doesn't make Lucinda vulnerable is that, in fact, the property that the mother didn't really like and didn't want turns out to be worth a great deal of money, and Lucinda will inherit a great deal of money, and of course she's guilty about that, and you could say a lot of Lucinda's gambling is sort of an attempt to get rid of that money.
Well, how does she get? How does she start gambling?
I can't remember, Lenny.
You wrote this book. You wrote this book how many years ago?
It was 25 years ago.
Well, it won the Booker in 1988.
Yeah. So I wrote it from 1985 to, so quite a while ago.
Lucinda goes to London for a time, but she doesn't fit in there either. Australia seems to be the perfect place for misfits like Oscar and Lucinda.
Well, it's full of them. Yes.
Even there, they struggle against society and propriety. Can you talk a bit about their relationship, as best you remember, 25
years
ago?
Well, it's true. So you shouldn't have me on the show with things I did 25 years ago. Their relationship.
You deserved that Booker in 1988, Peter. That's the reason we had you back for that one. Yeah. We've had you for all the new novels.
No, you have. Absolutely. Ones I could remember better. Appalling. Their relationship has to be sort of built on a misunderstanding. I mean, what their relationship really is, they love each other. And that Oscar wants to give her this gift, which he thinks it's like a love gift, to take this glass church up to the areas where the heathens and the blacks are living, and this act of madness and courage is his love letter to her, really. It's totally misconceived. She doesn't want him to do it. They have a bet. They have a bet that he can do it, and this sort of drives this.
Everything's about gambling here. George Eliot makes a cameo appearance in this novel. Just because she was of the right time and because you like George Eliot?
And because I like George Eliot and because...
You could have also included Dickens. You like Dickens a lot.
I think as a correspondent for this woman, I think Marion Evans is a far, far better correspondent than Dickens would be. And also, it allows the mother to have this conversation with an intelligent woman about the place of a woman in society at that time and someone who wants to be captain of their own ship.
As you were writing this book, did these characters come to you fairly well formed?
The sort of, without sounding complacent, because how can I be complacent about something I can't remember? The wonder of it as a writer is that, you know, I really did begin with an idea which is like a cartoon. That's the notion of the church. I didn't know there was an Oscar. I didn't know there was a Lucinda. And so every step in asking myself, how would that happen? Why would that happen? And how would it really be? Slowly, the characters get to be sort of built. And if one is self-questioning enough and self-critical enough, I think in the end they really do become real, contradictory, layered people. And at the they are sort of found by the process of the end of the novel. And that's sort of like the joy of it for me.
So you have the idea of the final third of the novel, and then you have to go back and set it up.
Yeah, how would that be? How would you ever get yourself into that? And really, what it is you know, it's an exercise, if you like, or a journey that you give yourself, or a task that lends you off into explore and discovers things that you didn't know you could know. You're writing about people you've never met, in a time that you've never lived, and indeed sort of stretching yourself beyond yourself into something that you hope is a lot smarter and more wonderful than you are.
Oscar and Lucinda meet on a ship called Leviathan. Now, obviously, names are really important. I don't know how you came up with Oscar and Lucinda.
I'm embarrassed about Oscar. You said I mustn't apologize for anything I did in the past. But, I mean, it's such a freaky English name, isn't it? I mean, to justify having an English clergyman named Oscar is pretty hard.
It's pretty wild.
I think. Well, yes, and the background is
wild. That was a bad joke, I'm sorry.
Oh, God, that was terrible. I never get puns. I think you know, where it really came from was the tin drum, really. It's the truth. The effect of Oscar in the tin drum stayed with me all those years and popped up when I was not really expecting to see it.
And Lucinda?
Took me a long time to get the name of Lucinda. What I wanted was a Victorian name that would feel modern and not sort of cliched. And the name I wrote the book under was the name Hermione. And I reached a certain stage towards the end of the book where I thought, I'm going to be on a radio show talking to somebody like Leonard Lopate, and I'm not going to be able to enunciate Hermione clearly. And so I started to look for other names. And then, of course, Lucinda means light. And it was really, it felt modern, it felt Victorian, and it was about the subject.
I wonder if J.K. Rowling had read your book, Oscar and Hermione, whether she would have had to give one of her characters the name Lucinda instead. There are other Hermiones in the world.
Yeah.
You write about Lucinda's father showing her a Prince Rupert's drop made of glass. What is that?
A Prince Rupert's drop is something that is super hardened glass, but traditionally it's happened accidentally. When a glassmaker, a little drop of molten glass drops into a cooling bucket of water. And if by chance the distance from how it's fallen and the temperature of the water and the size of the drop are right, it will create this beautiful object, which is like a large teardrop, if you like. And what's unique about it is that if you pick up a hammer and hit the thick end of the teardrop, you cannot break it. But if you just nip with a pair of pliers the tail of it, it explodes into this sort of wonderful glass fireworks, if you like, you know, across everywhere. And it's a lovely sort of thing. I did, of course, research it, and I did read about it, and I did go and meet a glassmaker who demonstrated this explosion for me. After the book was finished, all these scientists wrote to me who had done papers on Prince Rupert drops, and I wish I'd read them before I wrote the book. But anyway, it's...
You've written a variety of books set in many different times and places, but a number of them have been set in the 19th century. Is that because, as an Australian, the 19th century is so key to the way things turned out?
Yeah, I think that's really, really important that if you live in a... Well, I guess in most countries and most stories we tell ourselves, no matter what nation or state we come from, it's sure to be based on lies. And in the case of Australia, that's true. And we can look back only 200 years to the European part of our history, and we can want to know, how are we? How did we get to be like that? What really happened? What was it really like? And it's close and it's touchable.
Well, Thomas Keneally once told me that the difference between what happened in the United States and Australia is that the American pioneers went into the deserts and the bad country and all that, and then they came out in California, in paradise.
No, I told you that.
Should we?
I told you that.
And he said in Australia, they went into the center of the country and never came out.
Yeah, we got lost and died. It's really, and that's completely true. So, I mean, all of our stories do tend to be, the stories we feel comfortable with, tend to be about loss and defeat. And we trust loss and we trust defeat. And we're sort of suspicious of success.
Perfect for a writer who's writing about gamblers.
Yeah.
You've lived in New York for quite a while now, but many of your books are still set in Australia, partly set in Australia. Is Oscar and Lucinda a very Australian story? Could this have happened anywhere else?
I don't know.
Could the glass church have gone down the Mississippi?
Probably. I don't know.
Well, has leaving Australia changed the way that you write about or about your home country or the way you see it?
Well, I was very anxious to leave it because I write about it so much. I discovered that the great gift that distance gives you is, well, living here in New York, I mean, everything is strange. I mean, America is strange. The thing about America that was familiar before you got here now becomes strange. Your own country, which was intensely familiar, becomes stranger and stranger and stranger. And so as you're given the gift of seeing your country in a fresh way, and even if I have to explain, you know, the song of our heart, Waltzing Matilda, to my New York friends, and they say, well, what is it, Peter? And I say, well, Waltzing Matilda, which is really a song, is a song of a homeless man who steals a sheep and commits suicide rather than go to jail. And this is what tears us up. And this is what we would say is our song. And it's why no Australian Prime Minister can possibly adopt Waltzing Matilda as the national song, because what's he going to say to the Prime Minister or President next to him? What's your song about, Bob? Well, it's about
stealing sheep.
Yeah, stealing sheep.
You're the executive director of the creative writing program at Hunter College. Mm. You didn't take writing classes when you began, did you?
No, I didn't. And I
you worked in advertising. Was that good training for writing?
Well, advertising was of no use at all. But the working environment in the advertising agency was very good because it was filled with writers who were tremendously well-read and who were writing furiously at night, and they were my teachers. And I learnt from one of these men particularly, Barry Oakley. And as I was saying to one of my students just yesterday, you know, it might not be very good to be in an MFA program. I don't know. You could do it by yourself like I did, but it's probably going to take you about 10 years longer. And I think that's the one thing an MFA program can possibly, you know, really do for you, apart from giving you friends, which is useful.
Has teaching writing changed your own writing or how you think about the craft?
It must have. I don't know how. I do know that it's become an unexpectedly very beautiful part of my life, and that I get huge pleasure from. We've got a tiny program, and the students are not entitled, and they work hard, and they want to be there. So what's not to love about that?
Peter Carey's written a lot of books, 12 novels, but the one that won the first Booker for him in 1988 was Oscar and Lucinda, and that's one we've been discussing today. It is available in paperback from Vintage. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's always great to be here, Lenny. Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, the entire cast of the hit Broadway revival of The Glass Menagerie, Sherry Jones, Zachary Quinto, Celia Keenan-Bolger, and Brian J. Smith talk about the play that catapulted Tennessee Williams to fame. And then hockey legend Bobby Orr looks back at his remarkable career, explains how he revolutionized the position of defenseman, and talks about what he thinks of the game today. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Julia Corcoran, and Jessica Miller. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry and Matt Fidler with the audio controls. And we had help today from Brittany Mania and Hugh Sansom. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.